Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library's Glenn Seaboard Learning Consortium. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Marilis Castro, Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. Our moderator for tonight's program is Josh Richmond, Politics and Legal Affairs Reporter for the Oakland Tribune and Bay Area News Group. Now to introduce our speaker for tonight's program, Steve Poizner. Commissioner Poizner has had a life surrounded by many accomplishments. A graduate of the University of Texas, he was the class valedictorian while earning his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. 1978, he moved to California to attend the Stanford Business School and graduated 2 years later with his MBA and with honors. After his stint with the Boston Consulting Group, he founded and served as the chief executive officer of Strategic Mapping, a software company that displays geographical data on digital maps. In 1995, he continued his entrepreneurial streak by founding and serving as the CEO of SnapTrack, where he created the technology to add GPS receivers into phones, a function used by all of us today. SnapTrack was sold to Qualcomm in 2000 for a reported $1 billion. Not slowing down, Steve served as a volunteer teacher in San Jose's Mount Pleasant High School. As a teacher of 12th grade American government, he received the Rookie Teacher of Year's honors. Continuing his focused education, he also co-founded two nonprofits, EdVoice and the California Chapter Schools Association. In 2006, he ran for the office of California Insurance Commissioner, a position he handily won by 12% margin. In 2008, Commissioner Poizner announced his candidacy for governor of California. In addition to all of the above, Steve found time to earn a black belt in karate and marry his beautiful half, Carol, with whom he raises their beautiful daughter, Rebecca, in Los Gatos. And now, fresh from the debate, please join me to say hello to Steve Poizner.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. Well, you know, I've been insurance commissioner for 3 years now. I also, of course, candidate for governor for a while, so I get to go up and down the state of California giving lots of speeches. And sometimes the introductions don't go very well, unlike that one. It's very nice. I was at a high school recently. Student stands up to introduce me. The student had a really bored look on her face. Her introduction to me was short and sweet. She said, this is Mr. Poizner. He's been an engineering geek in Silicon Valley for 20 years. Now he's into insurance. That was it. She sat down. That was the whole introduction. When I got home that evening, I had to go talk to my 18-year-old daughter, Rebecca. I had to ask her, why did you introduce me that way? Sad but true. Thank you. My 18-year-old, she's applying to college. St. Mary's is on our list. Any St. Mary's fans here? Fantastic day for St. Mary's. Upset, fantastic. So as you heard, I spent most of my career a few miles from here in Silicon Valley starting and running high-tech companies. Definitely not a career politician, that's for sure. My last company, you probably haven't heard of the name until maybe just a few moments ago, is called SnapTrack. But I bet you do have my technology in your pocket, you know, right now. We did figure out a way to put a GPS receiver, a global positioning satellite receiver, into a cell phone, And so when you dial 911 from the cell phone, the emergency operators will know exactly where you're calling from. Well, that turned out to be an important feature. About 700 million cell phones have this feature. We have saved hundreds of lives with it. Just really proud of what the team did there. Did sell the company to Qualcomm a few years ago. And then after running companies in Silicon Valley for 20 years, I decided, okay, I have to switch gears. I simply can't sit on the political sidelines any longer. I could tell even a few years ago, California heading off of a cliff. People running the state oblivious to the fact that we're in a new global economy and we need to overhaul our state or our state's going to get steamrolled. Now, the first thing I decided to focus on wasn't to just run for office, but instead I did turn my attention to the public school system. Now, any high school folks here tonight at all? Now, I've come to the conclusion that, and I hope you agree with me, if we don't get California's public schools back on track, we'll never fix this great state of California. It's just essential. 50% of the fourth graders can't read. Now, how many of you went to California public schools? Just curious. Well, it looks like most of you. And that's the irony, right? We know how to educate kids. When we had a public school system up and running in the 60s and 70s, it was the best in the country. And we've gone from first to worst in a pretty short period of time. Now, what's happened? Now, as my daughter likes to kid me, you know, she says, you know, I am an engineer, that's a fact. And I'm an entrepreneur. I do like to fix things. I like to build things. Now, before I can fix something, I have to get into the trenches and understand the issues. I can't just peer from afar and try to figure it out. So that's why I decided to teach for a year. Now, that was an eye-opener. Now, I thought that the public school system might embrace me immediately. After all, I wasn't looking for compensation or anything. It actually, easier said than done to get into the classroom. So, you know, I live in Los Gatos with my wife and daughter. 30 minutes from here or so. And there's a school district in San Jose called the East Side Union High School District. Maybe you know that area. You know, the district office is on Story and White Road in East San Jose. About 25,000 high school kids, about 12 high schools. So it's about 30 minutes from my house. So I decided to drive to the district office a few years ago, this massive building that runs this gigantic district, and volunteer. Didn't make an appointment. Didn't call them in advance, just went there. And I went up to the receptionist and I said, I'm Steve Poisner, and I'd like to volunteer and teach, not looking to be compensated. Just want to help as much as I can. I want to learn as much as I can. The receptionist kind of tilts her head and says, what? Never heard that before. Hang on a second. So she goes to the back to get the head of personnel that hires teachers. I'll never forget, this was at lunch. By the time she got back to the front there, she had a pretty angry look on her face. I could tell I disrupted her lunch. She had a little mustard on her lip there. And she asked me, what can I do for you, sir? And I said, well, let me introduce myself. I'm Steve Poisner, not looking to be paid, want to help, want to volunteer and teach. And she says, what qualifies you to be in the classroom? I had to think about that for a second. I said, okay, I have an electrical engineering degree from the University of Texas. I did graduate the top of my class, and I went to Stanford Business School, graduated with MBA with honors. Then I spent 20 years starting and running high-tech companies in Silicon Valley, you know, pretty successfully. And then last year, I was in the White House, where I worked in the National Security Council in their counterterrorism group. I had a security clearance well above top secret. I got there 1 week before 9/11, and I helped build a new Homeland Security plan for the whole country. Without missing a beat, she looks at me and she says, nothing you've said qualifies you to be in the classroom. Now, I don't have a very big ego or anything, but my ego shrank in size that day as she sent me packing. But I wasn't going to take no for an answer. So I went home, got on the internet, pulled up the name of the 12 high schools in the East Side Union High School District, called all the high school principals directly, left them a message, I want to volunteer and teach at your school. None of them called me back, except one. Art Darren from Mount Pleasant High School calls me back, gets me on the phone and says, you want to teach in my high school? This is hard. Have you been here? I said, well, I would like to teach. Yes, absolutely. I know it's tough, but I want to help. So he goes to the superintendent of this massive district, gets me guest teacher status, and I taught 12th grade American government for a year at Mount Pleasant High School. Wow, gang members and all there. It was honestly the hardest thing I've ever done and the most rewarding. I loved it. Now, there are teachers here. I know there's some school board members. Let's hear it for teachers. I'm telling you, it's the most underappreciated All I needed to learn was on the first day. Then I got a clear picture of what's going on. First day, East San Jose, raining. It leaked in my classroom, had to position the trash can in the right spot to collect the rainwater. Now, hang on a second. This is Silicon Valley, wealthy Silicon Valley high school, leaky roof. Shameful. Why can't they fix the roof? Who runs the school at Mount Pleasant High School, really? Now, as it turns out, when you all went to the public schools, the teachers and the principals ran the school, but not anymore. I mean, now the legislature in the last several decades have taken over the running of the public schools to a great extent through the state education code. Now, the state education code, as some of the school board members can testify to it, the state education code are these mandates that are applied uniformly to all public schools at the same time. Now, there's 5,000 public schools in California. I mean, that doesn't make sense on the face of it. Now, in the 1960s, the state education code was about this size. Now, the state education code is this size, 2,000 pages long, and growing rapidly. I'll tell you one reason why I'm running for governor. I'm going to rip control of the public schools out of the hands of Sacramento politicians. I'm going to move it down to the local level where it belongs and where it used to be. Now, after a year in the classroom, I became really quite convinced that local control is a key part of the solution to our problems. And so after leaving the classroom, I then went off to help pioneer and build the California Charter School Movement. Now, I'm the founder of the California Charter Schools Association. I helped start a bunch of charter schools, Oakland, East Palo Alto, elsewhere. I don't know if you're following charter schools much, but I got to tell you, it's one of the most important education reform activities going on in California right now. See, charter schools are public schools, but they're granted waivers from the education code. It's the ultimate example in local control. Now, when I got involved with charter schools 10 years ago, there's just a handful of them. Now there's 805. 5% of all California public school kids now go to charter schools. Now, I want to give all public schools the same type of freedom and flexibility that charter schools have. That would be a huge, major step in the right direction. Now, my experience in the classroom not only helped me understand how hard it is to be a teacher and how we need to create a teaching profession again and how we need to empower teachers, but it also helped prepare me for my current job. Now, my current job is insurance commissioner. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Some of you are thinking just like now she's 18, my 18-year-old daughter. You probably think I have the most boring job in the state of California, insurance commissioner. Well, as it turns out, it's a great job. There's only 8 positions elected statewide. Now, I'm one of them. I have this huge, massive department of insurance. We oversee everything insurance, practically, in the state of California. Now, that's a big number, about $160 billion industry. About 10% of the entire economy. I'll tell you why I love my job. When I make a decision, it impacts everybody, every business, every consumer, every family. When I got there 3 years ago, I have to confess, culture shock for me. Over 1,000 employees, all of them belong to public employee unions, so there's collective bargaining agreements there. 6 different unions represent my employees. In addition to being a part of a public employee union, each person at the Department of Insurance also has lifetime civil service protection in addition to their collective bargaining agreements. So it's not like running a company in Silicon Valley, that's for sure. But I have wonderful people at the Department of Insurance, dedicated public service folks. I mean, it's a fantastic team. So together, what we did was, when I got there 3 years ago, I went to meet them all, first of all 1,000 of them, more than 1,000, across 16 different offices. It took me a few months. And together, my team and I, we built a strategic plan for the Department of Insurance. Now, I know a lot of you run companies or are in public service organizations or nonprofits. A strategic plan is an important document for any organization. It focuses any organization on just those strategic key issues, activities that really make a difference. Now, we went through every program, every dollar, every person. And lo and behold, I asked lots of questions. Now, why are we doing this program here? And all too often, the answer was, well, of course, we've been doing it this way for 50 years. Why are you asking? Well, does it help anybody? Well, not that we can tell. Well, then stop it. We got rid of dozens of programs. Other programs we ramped up. For example, I have 200 police officers that work for me at the Department of Insurance. Now, going after insurance fraud, now that I made a high priority, because insurance fraud in the middle of this recession drives up insurance rates at the worst time. Now, here's the results of this whole thing. Now, the Department of Insurance has been around for 130 years. The last time the Department of Insurance did a strategic plan and a top-down review was, well, never. And so the results have been pretty dramatic. insurance fraud. We've arrested over 2,000 people in insurance fraud in the last 2 years alone. That's more people to be arrested for insurance fraud than in any other two-year period ever in the history of the state. My operating budget has shrunk now because of this modernization and overhaul by 15%. So I've been able to cut my operating expenses permanently. I now have this big budget surplus at the Department of Insurance. I've taken this surplus and passed it back into the marketplace with two tax cuts on insurance agents and brokers and insurance companies that fund my department. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, honestly, I think you're looking at the only person in Sacramento history that's ever downsized anything. And here's what I want to do. As governor, I want to do the same thing I did to the Department of Insurance, to every single one of the 400 different state agencies and state departments. I can assure you all, none of them have been overhauled or modernized. Billions of dollars are being wasted. Can't afford that anymore. It's urgent that we modernize. I mean, urgent. I mean, we count on state government to do certain things for us very efficiently and effectively. It's just not happening. Now, and you know that all around us, the state's crumbling here. You know, in 1999, California was the sixth largest economy in the world. By 2003, we had fallen to seventh. Last year, eighth in declining. This state, our beautiful state that we all love so much, we are shrinking in terms of market share in the global economy at a rapid clip. No wonder our unemployment rate is 12.4%. That's the official unemployment rate. If you add in all the people who are underemployed, meaning they have part-time jobs but need full-time jobs, and then you add in all the people who've just given up looking for employment completely, well, that number is much higher, 20%. There's 4 million people in California that are underemployed or unemployed. Now, that's misery level, that's depression level misery going on in California right now. Now, where are all the jobs going? Well, let's take one of our not-so-friendly neighboring states of Nevada. Now, Nevada appointed a SWAT team. That SWAT team reports directly to the governor. And this SWAT team has one mission: recruit people like you all to move from California to Nevada. And they take out these full-page ads in California business publications. Maybe you've seen them. And other newspapers. The Tribune, maybe. And these ads have a simple message. And it says, if you do business in California, you're nuts. Come to Nevada where there's no corporate income tax, zero. Where there's no personal income tax, zero. Where the workers' compensation insurance rates are 30% less than here in California because of fewer mandates. And the electricity stays on. And lo and behold, people leave. Now, the U.S. Census Bureau, they're the scorekeepers here. They count the people as they leave. Now, this is pretty stunning, I think. 3,000 people a week pick up and leave the state of California each and every week now. Now, our population continues to grow. Even though we've lost 1 million people in the last 5 years, the state of California's population continues to grow because of illegal immigration and birth rates. So, ladies and gentlemen, honestly, this is the worst of all worlds, the perfect storm. We have consumers of government services coming in, and we have taxpayers leaving. Now, no wonder we can't balance the budget. Now, I'm running for governor to change things. Now, I think California is headed in completely the wrong direction, and we need a completely different direction in order to get California back on track. Now, as people evaluate candidates, as you look at candidates, some candidates are proposing more incremental changes or changes around the edges. Then if you're looking for that, then you're probably not going to be looking to me. I'm proposing game-changer approaches, sweeping, bold reforms, because that's what it's going to take in order to get California competitive again in this 21st century global economy. Three key parts to my reform agenda, and then I'd be happy to get into questions on any subject. But number one, the first thing we need to do is to cut taxes across the board. Now, I'm proposing a 10% cut in sales taxes, 10% cut in corporate taxes, 10% cut in personal income taxes, every bracket, and a 50% cut in capital gains taxes. Taxpayers go wild here. I appreciate that. Now, some people have asked me, lots of people have asked me, how on earth can we afford tax cuts? We can't balance the budget as it is. How do we fund this? Well, the answer is, how can we afford not to? I mean, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, we have one of the highest sales taxes, vehicle license fees, gas taxes in the country. One reason why so many taxpayers are leaving is because of the high tax structure. Now, we've studied this in other states. You watch what's going to happen. You lower tax rates, jobs will come back. So the tax rates are lower, but the tax base is bigger. And we actually have more tax revenues, not less, after the tax cut. Now, this wouldn't be the way it is if our taxes were at the national average or lower than that. And then you cut taxes, and you might not get that same effect. But when your taxes are already one of the highest in the country, driving businesses and jobs out of here, then you reduce taxes, then you get the positive impact immediately. And it's key. Centerpiece of my campaign, we'll never balance the budget without bringing more jobs back to the state of California. The second part of my reform agenda is to cut spending by 10% to balance the budget once and for all. Now, I'm not proposing across-the-board cuts. That's a mistake. I'm proposing to do to the state of California what I did at the Department of Insurance. There's a fundamental difference in doing a top-down review and overhauling, keeping certain programs, eliminating others completely, modernizing others. That's what I'm proposing to do with the state of California. I've gone through every page of the 1,200-page budget. And my plan's all on my website, stevepoisner.com, if you want to see the details, because everyone needs to know exactly what I plan to do in advance of the election. But we've gone through the budget, and we've identified $10 billion in cuts. Really, they're overhaul. They're overhaul changes, modernization to Medi-Cal, to our welfare system, to our prison healthcare system, and to each one of the 400 different state departments and state agencies. And we can balance the budget this way with no more taxes, no more borrowing, no more gimmicks, and no more smoke and mirrors. And it's essential. We have to balance the budget. And the third part of my reform agenda has to do with illegal immigration. Now, I know this is not something that most people who run for office even talk about. We are now paralyzed in this state. We can't even talk about illegal immigration because, you know, so many people get angry when you even bring it up. But let's just be honest. And I want to be the truth teller in this campaign. We can't afford the impact of illegal immigration any longer. Now, we see and feel the effect. I mean, honestly, before I go on, let me just underscore my commitment and my passion for legal immigration. I recruited people from all over the world in Silicon Valley. This state has benefited tremendously by having people move here legally. In our agricultural sector or high-tech sector, that's been a fantastic thing. I'm for making the legal immigration pipeline as big as possible. But illegal immigration, on the other hand, is costing the state billions and billions of dollars, and that's direct costs. Indirect costs are even hard to calculate. I don't know if you've been to an emergency room lately or a clinic. Place is overwhelmed, hours of waiting time because of the number of people who are here illegally using our healthcare system. Our public schools, when my first day at Mount Pleasant High School, we didn't even know how many kids would show up the first day because of illegal immigration. And teachers, they get spread very thin because of issues of teaching people who are here illegally. That's just got to stop. So I do want to end illegal immigration by turning off the magnets. I mean, people come here to either get jobs or to tap into our benefit structures. I'm for ending taxpayer-funded benefits for people that are here illegally. Thank you. Not that I don't appreciate, and I do very much, legal immigrants. They're just godsend to this state. But we need to turn the incentives off so people don't come here illegally in the first place. I also want better border security. We also have to enforce the rules on employers. If employers hire people here illegally, then as governor, I'm going to be tough, and I'm going to revoke their business license. People need to follow the rules here so that we end the problems with illegal immigration once and for all. Okay, finally, and then we'll get on to some questions here. Well, we know that we're in quite a jam. This is the worst economic meltdown since the Great Depression. Maybe it's the worst disaster crisis that the state's ever had in 160 years. So people ask me all the time, why on earth would you want to be governor in a situation like this? And honestly, this couldn't be a better time. Sometimes it takes a crisis really to focus people, to galvanize people on putting together a coalition to get at some of these structural problems once and for all. See, if you agree like I do that California is broken, if you agree that we need big, bold, fundamental reform to fix our state, if you agree that we can't wait much longer and it's urgent, then join me. I'm really looking forward to put together a new working coalition of Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike. We need to take our state back. And working together, we can and we will get this great state back on track. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate it. Thank you. So, question time. I would be happy to answer questions on any subject, so fire away.
Our thanks to Steve Poizner, California Insurance Commissioner and Republican candidate for governor. I'm Josh Richmond, the political and legal affairs reporter for the Oakland Tribune and Bay Area news group East Bay. We have a ton of questions here for you, Commissioner Poizner, so let's get right down to
okay.
it. First, not a great day in the polls. I know it's too early to necessarily believe the polls all the time, but the latest field poll shows you 49 percentage points.
There's been a poll?
There's been a poll,
okay.
in fact. Yeah, I know it's. I'm sure it's news to you. But when and how do you put on the afterburners to close that gap?
Well, it's a really good question because it's one thing, running for office and having ideas and campaigning, and that's fun and all, but I'm not running just to interact with people up and down the state of California. I'm running to win and get to work. Now, I don't know if you've seen the latest polls, but I'm the underdog. Let's put it that way. Now, why is that? It's not that people have evaluated Meg Whitman and me and decided to support her because they understand who I am and my background. People don't know me from Adam. And I got to say that it's kind of frustrating because I am the state insurance commissioner. And so the fact is, I get a lot of news, but when the Tribune writes about me, it's in the business section someplace. It kind of goes in one ear and out the other. Now, my opponent, Meg Whitman, and there's two good people running. You have to be pretty impressed that we have a competitive Republican primary and two people with interesting backgrounds and all. But Meg has spent $40 million so far. Now, you got to appreciate how much money that is. Now, $20 million is how much she spent in 2009, and $20 million is more money to be spent in a Republican primary for governor in the history of the country. So when you spend $40 million in this massive saturation advertising campaign and attack campaign and nasty, ugly, deceiving, and it's some nasty stuff going on. I mean, you can't miss it on TV, of course, on radio. When you do all of that and you're the only one advertising, then you drive up your name ID in the polls. Now, I'm just starting my advertising. There's 3 months to go. We've put together about $20 million, which I was pretty proud of because that was more money than has ever been put together for a Republican primary ever until Meg. And so we've got plenty of money, and now people are starting to pay attention. The last 3 months is plenty of time to get the word out. And the reason why the polls don't bother me much is because it's not like people know who I am or my background. They're about to know. And Meg and I, even though we come from Silicon Valley, there's some huge differences. And if it's okay, can I highlight just a few differences, which is why, this is why it addresses the issue of the polls. But let me say a few things real quick.
Sure.
Now, both of us have a lot of business successes, but just a few things for your consideration. Only one of us has started companies from scratch. And there's just a difference. Meg is a senior marketing company executive. She was in charge of Mr. Potato Head at Hasbro, eBay, of course. I mean, she's got a lot of really good marketing experiences, and that's for people to evaluate. Is that what you're looking for to run the state of California? In my case, I'm an entrepreneur and an engineer, as I mentioned, and my skill set's just different. Now, I'm also not a rookie to politics. The fact is I've proven, unlike most business people, that I can actually make the transition. Running the state of California is not a business. It's not. I mean, you can't hire, you can't fire. Our founding fathers, we set it up that way, checks and balances. And so I've proven my ability in the classroom, in the charter school movement, at the Department of Insurance, in the White House. Now, I have this 20 years of experience now at starting and running companies from scratch. I know how to bring jobs back, but I now have 8 years of success in politics, in public sector service. So this richness of my experience base will come out in the course of the campaign. I feel very confident.
All right. Well, let's ask a couple of questions that sort of come off of what you just said.
In fact,
you seem very proud of the work you've done as insurance commissioner. Why then did you choose to have businessman as your ballot designation in the ballot pamphlet? Would an insurance commissioner be a little more current?
Well, it turns out that insurance commissioner, when I first got there, I thought and talked to my team, can't we come up with a better name? I mean, commissioner, is there an insurance commission? Well, no. Am I a commissioner like the police commissioner on TV? Well, no. And so, unfortunately, when you see insurance commissioner, people just don't know what it is. Mm. Do you come from the insurance industry? Or do you represent the insurance company? Well, no. And so insurance commissioner just requires too much explanation. So I decided, what would be better? One of the key problems in the state of California is jobs. And we have to bring jobs back, as I've discussed. So my 20 years of experience not only starting and running companies from scratch, but my work as insurance commissioner in dealing with setting up a healthy business climate, we thought, you know, businessman would be the best descriptor there.
Okay. You talked a little bit about the money you've raised and the large amount of money that your competitor has given to her campaign. But you're actually number two on the top 10 list of top individual donors to causes and campaigns in the last decade. So is this perhaps, is it a little bit of the pot calling the kettle black? You've run up against somebody with a deeper pocket than yours at this point, right?
Oh, my gosh.
And is it possible for somebody without those means to run for governor?
Right, it's tough. And it shouldn't be that way, too. It's just a shame. You either have to really sell yourself to a special interest group or you have to be wealthy, and the state's so massive. I'm not complaining about how much money she's spending. I do think some of the spending is going to backfire on her. I mean, I do think it's so huge, the amount of money she's spending, that in the middle of this recession when people are struggling to make their mortgage payments and we have a $20 billion budget deficit, I think some people are going to find it pretty distasteful, especially the millions she's spending on sort of negative, nasty part of the campaign. Mm-hmm. So I was just going back to your first question. I was just explaining why the polls are the way they are. Mm-hmm. And it will take, you know, a lot of money on my part, you know, to raise my name ID. And so the next time I come back, I hope you don't say that you're sick of my commercials too, but you're going to start seeing a lot of them because it's really one of the only ways we have to do that in order to get the word out.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Steve Poizner, California Insurance Commissioner and Republican candidate for governor of California. It wasn't all that long ago that you were saying that you were a moderate Republican, that you were saying that you would stand up to Republican Party bosses, that the right wing of the Republican Party does not represent me. When we talk about evolution of political beliefs, very often it's on the scale of decades. This is on the scale of 6 years. So how are we to distinguish an evolution of beliefs from a politically expedient hard turn to the right?
Well, I do know that my political opponent wants to characterize it that way. Maybe some people in the press, too. But the fact is, I've been a conservative my whole life, and I'm proud of it. I mean, somehow the word conservative got a bad name somewhere along the line. I don't know why. But do you remember the show Family Ties? So I was the Alex P. Keaton of my household, the only Republican in a Democratic household. So I've been a conservative all my life, a Republican all my life. You know, I'm also fiercely independent. I'm not a partisan warrior, you know, where I want to go fight for, the Republican cause per se. Mm-hmm. I'm a conservative. I'm proud to be a Republican. I'm running, you know, to be the Republican nominee. But what I'm really after here is to be everyone's governor. It's not really a partisan cause. It's a cause about all of California. So I will say this, though. Over the last several years, my conservative views have crystallized ever since I've been in Sacramento. I got to tell you, the culture of corruption there, really terrible. And the amount of taxpayer waste and the amount of inefficiency and how quickly, you know, they want to raise taxes or borrow more money. I got to tell you, it's been a fantastic experience being an insurance commissioner. And now I have a really crystal clear vision and plan of where this state needs to go. So what you see is what you get in this campaign. I'm not running to one side and then running to the other in the general election. I mean, the platform that I outlined is my platform in the primary, in the general election. And I guess I must say I've grown as a person and as a political leader, evolved somewhat, but, you know, pretty much the same person I've always been.
Well, let's sort of aggregate a couple of questions here and build off of what you just said. If being in Sacramento has crystallized your conservative beliefs somewhat, couldn't the devil's advocate basically say you went to a hyper-partisan town where the legislature is essentially locked in gridlock every year on just about everything, and you, in fact, have gone far to one side? And how will that work out as a governor dealing with a legislature that seems to be almost irreparably gridlocked and is controlled by Democrats?
Yeah, well, when I say far to one side, per se, I mean, it's I am what I am, and you can put labels on it. I think conservative is a good label in the sense of, I mean, I believe in certain principles that I think a lot of Democrats believe in, a lot of independents, a lot of Tea Party types, a lot of non-Tea Party types, a lot of Republicans. I mean, I believe in individual liberty. I think this is a fantastic country. I think my most important duty as governor is to protect everyone's individual liberty. I believe in personal responsibility. That seems to be completely lost in the conversation these days. I think that we need to get that back in the conversation. I'm passionate about free markets and want to set up healthy competition for consumers. And I do believe in smaller, more accountable government, and I'm going to be campaigning on those issues. With regards to maybe another way to phrase your, you know, part of your question is how on earth are you going to get anything done?
Right.
And that's a really good question. And probably, I must say, the hardest question I get, and maybe the most important question I get. No easy answers. Let me just say that I run for governor with a full appreciation of the level of difficulty. I mean, we've gotten into this mess over a period of many years. It'll take a lot of work to get out of the mess. I have a three-part plan. It's not, you know, there's no silver bullets. I can't guarantee it. But I know that if we don't try, the state of California is going to go off of a cliff. So the first part of my plan is to be very specific about what I believe, my core principles, and my reform agenda, so that before anyone votes for me, they know exactly what they're getting in great detail. And then when they elect me, they're sending me to Sacramento with marching orders, with a mandate. And that will give me extra political capital. The second part of my plan to get something done is to utilize the power of the governor's office like it's never been utilized before. Now, you know, the governor on paper in California is very powerful. The appointments power, the line item veto power, the statute veto power, I plan to use that authority in a very focused, concentrated way on my reform agenda. We've got to get the economy back on track. We've got to bring jobs back, and that's what's going to be my focus. Finally, if the legislature does block all of my reform efforts, then we have no choice. We have to go directly to the people with a single issue, very specific, short and sweet, ballot initiatives that will reform California no matter what. I mean, the alternative is not thinkable, right? If we don't fix the state of California, we're going to get steamrolled. Now, some of the ballot initiatives that I will back, if I have to, include converting the legislature from full-time to part-time. If I could get away with it, I would create it, you know, go from full-time to no time, but I can't do that. The fact is, 42 states have a part-time legislature. I do think a part-time legislature would change the whole mix of people in the legislature. That's a ballot initiative that I think would overhaul the way the whole town operates. California had a part-time legislature. California had a part-time legislature from 1850 to 1967. And honestly, I think we began to deteriorate as a state when the legislature became full-time. And you get people from both parties that specialize in politics. And that is a mistake. We want people that come from the trenches. So anyhow, that's my plan of action. It won't be easy. I'm sure you'll be following everything I do very closely, but we're going to get this state back on track because the alternative is unthinkable.
Now, you're not the first Republican governor to say, if I can't get the legislature to work with me, I'll go straight to the people at the ballot box. And you know how that turned out. Do you believe that there's that those voters will be there for you when they were not there for this last special election that this current governor called?
Well, Governor Schwarzenegger and I, you know, are pretty good friends. We disagree on lots of things. People ask me if the governor Schwarzenegger can't get it done, how on earth are you going to get it done? Now, one thing I can say for sure is that no one's ever confused me for Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's for sure.
The poisonator?
So I do have a black belt. I think I could take him if I had to. It's you know, when the governor got elected in the recall, things were pretty bleak, but the unemployment rate was half what it is today. You have to zero in, I think, on the fact, the issue that we're in a meltdown, a crisis of epic proportions. And Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike have had it and are looking for big, bold changes. See, the change is going to have to come from the people, like it has in some other states. And I really do think that we got to take advantage of this crisis. That's why, as I said a moment ago, I'm just so excited about running for governor right now. Because a few years ago, I don't think I could have been as successful as I can be now, given that we're at the brink. And so what voters haven't had, I don't think in a long time, is someone to run for office, say what they mean, have a track record to back up their ability to get things done, and then fight like heck. And I can promise you this, I will have the tenacity and the backbone and the will to not budge. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to be rigid because you got to get things done. But you can't be compromising so quickly. They're always watching and seeing if you'll flinch. And on certain things, you just can't flinch. And getting this state's economy back on track is going to require some big, bold changes to our tax and our regulatory system. And I'm going to get it done one way or the other. You can fail the first time, you do it again. Now, the current governor just didn't have the long-term passion for reform. He got beat pretty badly, moved on to other things. I think that was a mistake.
Okay. Well, this has been mostly politics. Let's get specific and down in the weeds on some policy here. We've got a huge pile of questions, which are basically all the same. Is college education a right or a privilege, and what are you going to do to make it more affordable?
As a parent who's about to send my daughter to higher education, to college or university here, hopefully in California, I'm really care about this issue, of course. I do think our higher education system is a crown jewel of California, and we've studied it pretty closely. You know, every dollar we invest in our higher education system, we get a 4x return. I mean, it's a fantastic investment. But, you know, taxpayers do highly subsidize our college system. You know, about, believe it or not, 90% of the cost of community colleges paid by taxpayers. About 50% of the state university system paid for by taxpayers. About 40% of the UC system paid for by taxpayers. Now, highly subsidized. Good thing. I think that's a fantastic investment. You know, and so even though fees have gone up a lot, you know, it's still a great value, great deal compared to other states. We should appreciate that, what taxpayers are doing here. It's still a massive investment. I don't support any more fee increases because that would just make it unaffordable. And I think one of the real fantastic things about California is that our higher education system is so affordable for so many people. I do think it's hard to transfer from one part of the higher education system to another. I think that needs to be streamlined. But the bottom line is, as governor, you got to set priorities. You know, we have about $85 billion that comes into the state of California right now, even during the middle of this recession, $85 billion. And so how are you going to spend it? How are you going to prioritize it? I mentioned my top priority is individual liberty, public safety. That's going to be my top priority. But right up there close to the top is my support for education in general and higher education in particular. And right now, we just don't have the money. We don't have the money to invest in higher education the way we'd like to. We don't have the money to invest in K-12, don't have the money to fix our water infrastructure, don't have the money to fix our broken healthcare system. So honestly, you know, when people say we need more money here, there, or whatever, well, have they checked? We're bankrupt, effectively. We don't have money. We're out of cash. Worst credit rating in the country. So we've got to balance the budget once and for all, and then we have to fix our economy so we can get California back on track. And then when we have revenues coming in from a healthy economy, then I can assure you one of my top priorities will make sure that the higher education system gets fully funded.
Now, part of your budget platform is a top-down review and overhaul of state government to realize some savings there. Sort of a two-part question. How do you estimate that $3.85 billion that you'd save in that overhaul if you haven't done it yet? And B, the census says that California, at least in 2008, had the third lowest number of full-time equivalent state government employees in the country and also had the fifth lowest ratio of K-12 education employees, 19% below the national average. So are we really so bloated?
Well, when Governor Schwarzenegger took over a few years ago, we had 300,000 state employees. We now have 350,000 state employees. Government spending has basically doubled in the last, you know, 15 years or so. We know for sure we can't keep up at that pace. That's a fact. And my experience at the Department of Insurance is that even though there was a lot of fantastic people there, and there still are, I mean, it's a great team, there's just huge amounts of inefficiency and waste. So one way I was able to shrink my operating budget by 15% was to infuse some new technology. And let me just give you one quick example, and then let me talk about my $3.85 billion plan. Mm-hmm. Now, any insurance agents or brokers here? Just curious. No one in the insurance industry. The insurance commissioner comes to speak in the East Bay, and not anyone from the insurance industry.
What does that tell you?
Yeah, maybe it's a good sign, because if they weren't happy, they'd be here. I can tell you that. There's over 300,000 insurance agents and brokers in California. And they can't sell insurance without a license from me and my team. That's the way it works. And the license are good for 2 years. And every 2 years, we do a criminal background check to make sure that they're not breaking any laws, and then we give them a test to make sure they're keeping up on insurance issues. So, but when I got to the Department of Insurance 3 years ago, it was all paper-based. These 300,000 applications coming in, I mean, it took dozens of people and months to go through. We automated the whole thing. And so even though my operating budget's down, with some technology, we've cut the processing time from months to days, and the number of people way down. And now I mean, the whole thing's automated. So across the state of California. So I have this experience of doing it. I mean, you're looking at someone who's actually taken a very large state agency and right-sized it. So I've looked at the other 399 state departments and state agencies, and we've examined their operating structures, you know, at a high level. And we think it's a pretty conservative estimate that we can get the same kind of 15% savings in operating expenses at every department and every agency, because none of them have been overhauled and modernized. And if you look at their operating budgets, that comes to $3.85 billion. And that's, you know, of an $85 billion budget, that's not, we don't think that's being overly optimistic.
All right.
Another hybrid question. Do you support, talk a little bit about your position on offshore drilling here. And also, there is a bill pending in the legislature right now that would impose an oil severance tax, which is something that most oil-producing states have, in order to raise funds specifically for higher education. What do you think of that idea?
Right. Well, I just don't support any tax increases on just any tax increases. Because if you have to ask yourself, by raising taxes, are we going to get more employment or less employment? And the answer is going to be we're going to get less employment. Now, oil companies aren't getting away with any particular bargain here. They pay property taxes. They pay high corporate income taxes. They pay all kinds of taxes. If you look at their total tax burden, they're paying a lot of taxes. I mean, so it's not like they're skating away without any paying their fair share. I think they are. So raising taxes is just going to discourage them from expanding here, and that's to be a mistake in the middle of this recession when we need jobs. With regards to offshore oil drilling, I support it. I support it because in the last few years, there's been remarkable progress in this slant drilling technology. And also in the stability of these offshore platforms. Take a look at Katrina, that terrible disaster. Now, those hurricanes impacted at least 100 offshore oil platforms off the Gulf Coast. And there was a very, very small amount of oil seepage from Katrina. It was impressive, to be honest with you, how the offshore oil industry held up nicely in that terrible disaster. Now, here in California, we have a bunch of offshore platforms. I wouldn't build any new ones, but I would allow some additional drilling using this new slant drilling technology off of existing platforms. There are billions and billions of barrels of oil off our coastline. We don't have to take any environmental risks here. We have to make sure they use this new modern slant drilling technology, which can be used off of an existing platform or onshore to offshore. And honestly, if we're willing to drive around and consume lots of gas and use a lot of oil in other parts of our economy here, why shouldn't we become more self-sufficient? Why is it okay for Saudi Arabia or Texas or Louisiana to do it, but we won't do it here? It's just not right.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Steve Poizner, California Insurance Commissioner and Republican candidate for governor of California. Let's do some rapid-fire word association here, huh? Tea Party.
Is this like password?
Yes. Yes, it is. Tea Party.
Individual liberty, free markets, lower taxes. I like what the Tea Party movement's up to. I think they're on the right track.
Gun control.
Big believer in the Second Amendment. People have a right to bear arms. The Constitution's crystal clear about it.
Water or the lack thereof.
Man-made crisis. I don't know if you've been to the Central Valley. Can I explain just a little there?
Please.
Thank you. Central Valley devastation. 30,000 farm workers, met with a lot of them, lost their jobs because of the man-made water crisis. About $1 billion of crop damage. Now, the pumps in the Delta have been turned off by court order. one unelected federal judge has taken over the water supply of the state of California. There's rationing going on now in San Diego. It's just not right. Now, when I taught 12th grade American government, I had the honor and the privilege of teaching the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. One of my favorite amendments to the Constitution, well, the freedom of the press is my favorite on behalf of the Chronicle. But the 10th Amendment is one of my favorites, too. The 10th Amendment is the state's rights amendment. And I really do think that elected officials here in California need to make the trade-offs about how to deal with our water supply and not the federal government. And as governor, if we still have this problem, I will appeal this federal decision all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court based on states' rights issues. We've got to turn those pumps back on. We really do, because the environmental damage and the damage to farm workers and farmers have been just terrible. Now, on the other hand, I also support investing more in our water infrastructure. We haven't really expanded our water infrastructure in decades. We need more water infrastructure, and there we need to step up and make those long-term investments.
Question from the audience. Tax cuts take time to result in economic growth. How do you fund the deficit in the meantime?
I think it's a great question because people assume that there's some big delay. And so I was worried about that too. You know, I'm a passionate believer in tax cuts, but how long will it take? So my team in my campaign, we looked at the other 49 states, and we examined in the last 20 years every time we could find a state that had that passed across-the-board tax cuts like I'm proposing. And in almost every case, tax revenues went up, not down, the first year after the tax cut. Now, I wanted to quantify the impact of my tax cut plan, so we took an average of about a dozen states we found that had tax cuts, and the average increase in tax revenues after the tax cut the first year was about 1.5%. I mean, it was positive, and it was 1.5%. The second year, it grew to 3.5% or so. The third year was even higher, so it builds. But there's a lot of pent-up interest and demand to come back to California. The tax cuts would have, the reason why the tax cuts will have an immediate positive impact, you know, a couple of reasons. One is it does change the economics, and there's always people evaluating where they're going to build a new company or expand a new company. So if you change the economics, you'll get an immediate positive impact from that. The second thing, though, is that we're just sending a message to entrepreneurs and investors everywhere. California is not going to be your worst nightmare anymore. We're actually going to want companies to come here and create jobs. And it would send a very powerful message. And since this is California, we're such a beautiful state, the impact, I think, would be immediate and positive.
All right. Another question from the audience. If you become governor, will you impose restrictions on California businesses that exceed the limits of laws passed by the legislature, such as you have done in requiring insurance companies that have invested in international companies doing business in Iran to list them as non-admitted assets?
Yeah, so just a quick update on Iran. Occasionally we all have to just band together and just do the right thing. Now, I believe Iran is a huge threat to its own people, to its neighbors, to the national security of this country. So as insurance commissioner, one of my duties is to make sure that insurance companies invest your premium dollars in a safe and secure fashion. So in my job of just overseeing these insurance companies, I noticed that they had billions and billions of dollars invested in companies that were doing business in Iran. I mean, that's just wrong. I mean, your insurance premiums are helping to prop up the Iranian regime. So in my position as insurance commissioner, I told these insurance companies, you got to change it. You got to stop that. And it's about $6 billion. Now, they have a $4 trillion investment portfolio. So it's a small part of their investment portfolio, but it's several percent of the gross domestic product of Iran. So it's kind of one of these win-wins where they could get rid of these assets. This is not pretty easy for them to do that. So I'm going to get them to do that. On the other hand, it'll put pressure on Iran, you know, which is the right thing to do. So as governor, I do believe, and there are sanctions and federal policy that supports this and state policy as well. As governor, I do believe that companies that operate here in California should follow the rules. And just as I've done as insurance commissioner, it's if I find companies that are breaking the rules, not fulfilling their legal obligations to their consumers, you know, I'll pounce on them because it's not right for consumers not to get, you know, the deal that they've, you know, they've made with the company. And companies need to follow their legal obligations. That's the way our free market system works.
Okay. We have a couple of questions. I'm sorry. We have a few questions here about K through 12 education. I think people would like to hear a little bit more specifically what you'd like to do to improve our situation besides just turning some local control back over. A couple of people asked if you feel like the teachers' unions have too much control, and if so, what you would do about it. And there's some question about the fact that California currently ranks pretty close to the bottom in terms of per capita K-12 spending. And do you feel like we've adequately funded our K-12 system?
Well, first of all, let me do address the question of public employee unions. So at Mount Pleasant High School, I worked with all those other teachers that were part of the California Teachers Association. I mentioned at the Department of Insurance, I have over 1,000 employees that are a member of public employee unions. You know, we really do have some fantastic public servants here in the state of California that work for K-12 or for the state of California. But I got to be honest with you, the power of the public employee unions is out of control, and we need to curb the power of the public employee unions. Now the membership. Public employees are one thing, but the leadership has gotten to be very powerful, and they block reform. So public employees comprise a very small percentage of our total population, but they have the lion's share of the political power in Sacramento. It's just a fact. And so I do support a new initiative that's being circulated. I strongly encourage you all to sign it so we can get it on the ballot. It's the Paycheck Protection Initiative, which basically says that a public employee union has to get permission from the public employee member first before pulling money out of their paycheck to use it for political purposes. I mean, that would go a long way. Okay, so that doesn't apply. That's not just the CTA. I was talking about all public employee unions. I know that they're not pleased when I talk about this, and I want to work with them. I have worked very successfully with the public employee unions, plan to do so in the future, but we just have to recognize that their power needs to be curbed. Now, with regards to the public school system, we did a couple other thoughts on how I would reform it. Now, I wish I could, you know, go to the whiteboard and draw it, but picture this. There's 5,000 public schools in California, 5,000, 6 million kids. I mean, this is enormous. There's more kids in our public schools than most states have total people. I mean, it's enormous, huge. So we got 5,000 public schools that report to 1,000 school districts. Now, some school districts have dozens of schools. Some school districts, like a couple hundred of them, have one school. Now, no matter whether you're a big school district or a small school district, you have staffs and superintendents and boards. Now, these 1,000 school districts report to, you know, 58 county boards of education. Now, each county board has a staff and a superintendent and lots of expenses, no matter if it's a big county or a small county. Now, the 58 county boards of education report to, well, it's not clear. There's the elected superintendent of public instruction. There's the secretary of education. There's the department of education. There's the state board of education. So this is a highly fragmented, dysfunctional system. And now take this highly dysfunctional system that's so fragmented and overlay the 2,000 pages of the education code, and you have, you know, a system that's grossly deteriorating rapidly. Here's a number for you. There's 600,000 people who work in K-12 in California, 600,000. Over half of them are not in the classroom. That's just wrong. And there's a lot we can do to flatten this system out.
In what's almost certainly a related question, how can the public employees' pension benefits be modified to help us out of our jam here?
Well, I do think that people like Bill Lockyer, now the treasurer of California, people like Mayor Willie Brown and others, these are, you know, lifelong successful Democratic leaders that have all came to the same conclusion. You know, the public employee pension structure is not sustainable economically, needs to be changed. Now, what I want to do is to modify the pension structure, at least for new employees, by making public employee union pensions look more like what you would find in the private sector. And so that would be a healthy thing, because right now public employees, I mean, as good as they are, the fact is they have a compensation structure that isolates them from the ups and downs in the economy, unlike people in the private sector. So we should align the incentives of people in state government and in the private sector so that when the economy goes up, they feel the joy of it, and when the economy goes down, they feel the pain. We need that kind of an alignment, and that's what I'd push for.
All right. Question from the audience. Have you given any thought to the effects of a lack of medical care to illegal immigrants, the illegal population in California, and what about the lack of education for children of illegal immigrants?
You know, those are really good questions. You know, the fact is we feel the effects of the impact of illegal immigration every day. So, as I mentioned earlier, if you go into an emergency room, everyone's health care is impacted because people have come here illegally in large numbers. You go into our public school system, everyone's education gets impacted because of the numbers of people who come into our public school system that come into our state here illegally. So it's kind of one of those things where we're a very caring people. You know, if we weren't bankrupt, you know, we would be thinking about other things. But unfortunately, the state's out of cash, and our public school system is deteriorating, and our public health system is overwhelmed. So it's kind of one of those things where we have no choice now, in my opinion, but to find a governor, me, who's willing to make stopping illegal immigration a priority. And so we have to do this thoughtfully and carefully so that we don't hurt anybody, you know, and we phase things out, and we you know, have some date certain when services stop. But we need to provide people with the information they need to make a decision. Okay, we can't come here anymore because we're not going to be able to tap into all these taxpayer-funded benefits. Then they'll change their behavior because, you know, you can't build a fence big enough or a wall high enough. We have to change the way humans think about it. We don't want them to come here illegally in the first place. And so that's why we ultimately just need to turn the magnets off. And when you turn the magnets off, illegal immigration is going to slow down and stop. And that would be very important for the state of California.
We're getting down to the point where we may only have time for one or two more questions.
Okay.
Question from the audience. My insurance went up 34% recently with Anthem Blue Cross. As insurance commissioner, what are you doing about this, and specifically all insurers, from raising their rates that much?
Finally an insurance question, but it had to be that one. Here's the scoop on auto insurance and homeowners insurance. Let me start there, then get to health insurance. Homeowners insurance and auto insurance, over the last few years, you know, I have a lot of oversight over the way they price their products. We make sure that they don't, you know, gouge. And health and auto insurance and homeowners insurance in the last couple of years have gone down by $2 billion. And we've brought in a lot more competition, and those markets are healthy and very competitive, and I'm proud of the fact that all those insurance products are very affordable for Californians. Health insurance, on the other hand, I don't have I can't have much impact there as I wish I had. One reason why I want to run for governor is that I'll be in a position where I can have a bigger impact. So the health insurance markets are broken up into two buckets. There's the HMOs, which is about 70% of the market in California, regulated by the governor. I oversee everything else, which is the remaining 30% of the individual markets. Now, the law in California doesn't give me any control over their prices. Not that I'd want them, but I just don't have control. They can price it any way they want. I do have one law, though, that I'm making sure that they comply with. And there's one law that says, insurance commissioner, make sure that insurance companies spend at least 70 cents on every dollar they collect in health insurance on actual health care. Now, Anthem Blue Cross, largest health insurer in the country, largest health insurer in California. They have 57% market share here in California in the individual markets. So I'm sure you've all been reading. A couple months ago, they announced that they wanted to increase prices of every health insurance policy in California by an average of 25% and up to 39% for some people. So when they announced that, I got to tell you, I was pretty outraged. And I'm looking at their market share of 57%, and I'm going, well, gosh, there's not a lot of competition here. It looks like they're taking advantage of these people. And so I called up the management team. They flew to California, and I got them to suspend their rate increase. I mean, zero. So they're not changing their prices at all through May 1st. And they've agreed, along with my team at the Department of Insurance, to hire outside experts. We're going through their books right now with a fine-tooth comb. And we're gonna. And the only thing I can do, the only power I have, is to make sure that they're complying with that 70% rule, meaning that I'm going to make sure, you can count on this, that they're spending at least 70 cents on every health insurance dollar on health care. Of course, the ultimate answer here is we need more competition, which is why I support allowing health insurance companies to be able to sell health insurance across state boundaries. We get instantly a lot more competition. That would drive down prices.
Very good. I think we're just about out of time. So our thanks to Steve Poizner, insurance commissioner and Republican candidate for governor of California. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Josh Richman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you very much.